sort of the story of Kill Screen, I feel like, is, you know, on the one hand, kind of well documented, but on the other hand, I think there's probably still a lot of people who don't know about Kill Screen, and probably a lot more who don't really.
What? Everyone doesn't know about Kill Screen? That's crazy. I find that implausible.
Welcome to Playable Character. I'm your host, Shane Hinton. In each episode, we gather together short segments from bloggers, podcasters, developers, and gamers that expand our understanding of game culture and hopefully expand our ideas about what a gaming podcast can be. In our first segment today, Sean Ryder spoke with Jamin Warren about Killscreen, the gaming periodical that doesn't want to be just another video game magazine.
Like any form of criticism, I mean, I think that games are both easy and difficult to write about. I think that music, by far, is the most difficult thing to write about, and that's where Chris and I were coming from. We were coming from music background. There's that quote about writing about music is like dancing about architecture. The music is incredibly abstract, and so it's the job of the writer to create this language. But I think there's probably a lot more similarities between, at this point, I think, between like good travel journalism or good food journalism. I had a really interesting discussion with Adam Platt, who's New York Magazine's food critic, and he was talking about sort of what the role of the food critic was, and he was saying that, you know, one of the challenges with writing about food is that you're describing a particular experience on a particular day. In some cases, with particular restaurants, those meals won't even be available to a particular person who's walking in later based on what they had read in the review. And I do think there's some similarities there, certainly with games, in that, you know, games are these intensely personal experiences, and though obviously there are limitations to what you can do in a game, you know, there are code-based limitations. You can't do everything that you want. From a critical standpoint, you know, one of the big challenges that we faced is trying to figure out a way to write about games from a critical perspective that doesn't sound like software reviews, where you're just checking off boxes, graphics were like this, the story was like this, the new mechanics felt like this, et cetera, et cetera. Where you just have these obligatory boxes, because that's where games criticism kind of sat for a very long time, in part because it came out of, you know, software. We were looking to try and do something a little bit broader, particularly on the review side, and that's done more through the website. You know, the origin for us was really, you know, ironic enough, there's no shortage of good reviews out there, but there is a shortage of good features. We launched this partnership with Pitchfork earlier this month, and one of the things that Pitchfork did really wisely, you know, 15 years ago when that site was getting started, was Ryan Schreiber, the founder, decided to make an entire website entirely devoted to indie rock, which no one was really covering. But more importantly, he created an entire site that revolved around reviews at a time when music publications didn't tell you reviews. Reviews were the thing that were thrown in the back of the book. Games have the opposite problem, which there's plenty of critical thought about games, good and bad, some good, some good, some bad. But a lot of the feature writing that should be done about games really, really isn't. You know, there's a lot of people who just have kind of a lot of older game designers whose stories never really get told. And, you know, the big issue is that, that game sites, for the most part, focus on products and they don't focus on people. And so that's where we wanted to really distinguish ourselves, is that we felt like people who made games were these really special, creative individuals, and trying to find ways to tell their particular stories was really, really important to us. The other side being telling the stories that individuals have when they play games, and not the experience of playing the game itself, but these sort of extra, you know, extra contextual experiences that they have where what happens to them in their game world intersects with what happens to them in real life. We take a lot of our cues from other types of critical writing. Sports writing, because sports writing is another place. And sports and games are very similar. They're obviously all rule-based activities, and so that makes writing about games, I think, is probably closest to writing well about sports. But you don't see a lot. In that sense, we weren't seeing a lot of really good long format game criticism, game journalism. And that really bothered us. And we felt like there was really a place. If there was ever a place to kind of iterate on game writing, that was the spot to do it. There are obviously a lot of problems. There are a lot of things, I think, preventing games from assuming their rightful place in the cultural pantheon. But I think one of the biggest ones is PR. I think games have a PR problem, and I think there are different ways to communicate ideas, certainly through writing and through dialogue. But design is a place where you can really communicate value, and that was what really animated our desire to start a print publication, was there was an appreciation for physical objects and physical goods. And I had an existing friendship with a fellow who was coming out of a magazine print background and worked with Shepherd's Ferry on Shepherd's Ferry's magazine, Swindle. And so, you know, it seemed to me when I was looking through a lot of video game publications, and then I'd look at other music magazines like The Wire, or I'd look at fashion magazines, or surfing magazine like Surfers Quarterly, or just as someone who's interested kind of in print as a way to communicate ideas. I felt like video games were a place where that was, you know, certainly good design was really needed, and that would be a way to impart a particular type of value onto video games. So that's why we don't use a lot of screenshots, for example, unless they're absolutely necessary. We like using illustration and photography. The big reason for that is that, they can become dated very, very quickly if you use a current screenshot. You know, because that's just the nature of games, right, is that they use the most advanced technology of the time, but 5-10 years from now, there's basically this gap where things look good for like a year or two, and then they start to fade, and then they look a little bit ridiculous, and then 10 years later, they look nostalgic. You know, because if you look at old Nintendo Towers or something like that, you'd never say, oh my gosh, this doesn't look very realistic. You just say, oh, that looks like old Nintendo, and so you kind of have this sort of nostalgia that's attached to it. The problem is that you do have that kind of that trough where things don't quite look as good as the new things that are out. So you look at games like Crysis or Crysis 2 or Battlefield 3, which are incredibly realistic, and probably even those, you know, a couple of years from now will somehow look slightly lackluster. So anyway, so that was a big, that was really important to us, communicating value through really, really good design. And again, not taking our cues from other game magazines, but take our cues from, other design journals, other types of magazines that are thinking the same way about the print medium. And that's the way we talk about the website too. It's like when we think about what we want to do with the print website, it's more like we look at Slate, we look at Pitchfork, you know, we look at other Feed the Morning News, we look at other feature-based websites as opposed to other game websites. They already do what they do very, very well, and we're not going to be able to compete in terms of breaking news like Kotaku or IGN. They already have a huge staff, and they have pre-existing relationships, and they already have that engine kind of running. And so rather than, crowd that space with more of that, let's figure out to try and add something that's not being included. I think fortunately for us, people often think about video games as being a niche interest. But it's a really enormous niche, right? It's a $60 billion niche. And so, if we can take a sliver of that audience, that's still a very, very large audience. We felt that there was an older video game consumer whose interests were not necessarily being met by other existing websites. Not just in terms of design, but also in terms of curation. I don't necessarily, I do have time to do this because it's my job, but most people, that I know don't necessarily have time to wander through, 80, 90 posts on a game blog, for example, and they might not necessarily care about every single incremental change in a new game title that's coming out. Some people do, fans absolutely do. But there are a lot of casual consumers out there who play hardcore games but don't fit into a traditional demographic. For us, it's really about trying to live for this, 25 to 40-year-old video game person who's grown up on games but is now busy with children and jobs and all sorts of other things. That's really what informs our decisions to go about things a certain way. We tend to think about video games not necessarily as an entertainment medium, but to think about it as a worldview, an interest that informs other states of your being, the way that the internet did, or the way that rock and roll did it, right? Like, rock and roll was music, but it was a type of culture as well. And so we feel the same way about video games. And so when you look at it that way, it makes it a little bit easier to say, oh, what are the interconnections between games and other parts of your life? So, like, Inception, that's a video game movie. They don't talk about video games, you know, explicitly in that film, but there's a lot of video game ideas in terms of, like, dual identities and dream states and manipulating reality. These are all things that definitely resonate with someone who's grown up playing games. As far as, like, the practical aspects of getting people who are outside of the sort of traditional game writer circle, you know, some of that was a function of just my and Chris's background not necessarily being in that world. And so a lot of the people that I was with, you know, certainly were not traditional game writers, although many of them played games. Game writing is often labored with the perception that the only way that you can write about games is if you have played lots and lots and lots of them. Like, in general, game writing, the value there is this encyclopedic knowledge. It's not that that's necessarily a bad thing, but we would much rather have someone who loves the mechanics of writing than someone who loves video games. Because it's very, very easy to get someone to love video games. It's very, very hard to get someone to love writing. This idea that there's you know, this swaths and swaths of people who haven't had any experience with video games at all is certainly not true. You know, certainly think about, like, Angry Birds, for example. You know, it has, what, like 100 million downloads or something like that. I mean, so many people are playing games, so many people have grown up on games, so many people have had, you know, intersections with game culture that this idea that, you know, that young writers or writers of any stripe no longer would not have any interaction with games, I think is really untrue. And you even look at, like, the Nicholson Baker piece that I know is derided, the one from The New Yorker. We basically just talked about the experience of being a new video game player. Like, that, those kinds of experiences have value also. I think we often take for granted that some people don't have wide experience with video games, but have the ability to communicate what their particular experience was in a game world, and that has value. Whether or not they know, you know, every single character from Metal Gear Solid series or, you know, the whole chronology of Metal Gear Solid games doesn't necessarily disqualify them from writing about their experience playing that particular game. Okay, a lot of this comes from my background just as a journalist. I often wandered into new fields that I didn't know a ton about, but I felt like I had the inquisitive toolbox to be able to make something out of that, that I was able to ask the right kinds of questions and ultimately get a really good story. The goal for Killscreen is not to be thought of as, like, a video game magazine. The goal for Killscreen is to be a culture publication that writes about video games. Part of the way that you do that is by bringing in people from outside the fold and get them to care about what you're working on. You know, there's basically two kinds of polls. There's definitely, like, the super academic, you know, Bogosian, Tracy Fullerton, you know, there's sort of the great academic game thinkers of our time. And then there's, like, the super, super mass market stuff. So, like, the IGNs and the Kotakus of the world, both of which are incredibly valued, but both of which do very, very different things. And so we're kind of nestled in between. I like to think that we're, you know, we're more ambassadors. So those groups reach their respective audiences very, very well. So obviously IGN reaches a lot more people than, you know, than any of the game studies blogs or Brainy Gamer, all of which we love. We think that's great. We just felt like there was space in the middle to be able to basically communicate some of these more academic ideas to a section of that much larger audience. I think, you know, one of the other problems is that a lot of times these ideas that that these conversations that people have about games in academic contexts don't make their way out into the wider world. Partly that's just a function of academia. Academia is not always necessarily concerned about communicating ideas to everybody else. That's a whole other discussion you could probably talk about, but that's not necessarily their chief end. You know, they're interested in getting tenure and being respected by their peers, you know, basically being published in peer-reviewed journals, that sort of thing. So we, you know, so for us, you know, I think that one of the big problems with games is that there isn't a vernacular for games, there isn't a native tongue, there isn't this common language that people can use to talk about games, even for people who play games their entire life. I don't think they often understand a lot of the things that academics take for granted about how games work. So, like, even that basic fiction mechanic divide, right? Like, you don't look at a game based on what it's about, but you look at it based on, you know, you look at it based on, you know, on its mechanics or some sort of blend in between the two of those. But that's a conversation that academics have, but it's not necessarily a conversation, that like everybody else in the world ever has. So I think that's sort of our job, is to communicate some of those more complex ideas to a much larger audience. And I think that will be what makes Kill Screen work, is that, you know, we get to be a translator. I don't want Kill Screen to be pigeonholed as like sort of an academic sort of pursuit, because I don't think that that's necessarily true. I think we're certainly intellectual, but I would not describe it as academic at all. One of the hard things about being a business owner is that, you know, you just see lots and lots of mistakes. And so you don't, even though, you know, you see lots of what I would say is like, you know, external signs of success, you don't always think of those. All I see are the things that we should be doing better. Killscreen is doing incredibly, incredibly well. Our lasting success will be the ability to attract people who don't self-identify as gamers, but are attracted to ideas or the writers. That, I think, will be our biggest, that will be our biggest challenge and our biggest blessing going forward, because that audience is much, much larger than like a quote-unquote traditional game audience. I couldn't be happier with the way things are going with Kill Screen since it should have to be, you know, 18 months ago when the Kickstarter project launched, like, you know, what I would be thinking about where we would be. It wouldn't be here. I wouldn't have guessed that at all. In some ways, we're perhaps a little bit naive. I think you meant, you know, that just people would sort of get what we were trying to do. We were very lucky in that respect.
In our next segment, I spoke with programmer and blogger David Carlton about architecture and labor inside Minecraft.
I first heard about Minecraft seeing people in my Twitter feeds talking about how they're staying up too late playing it, or my coworkers at Playdom, you know, would talk about how they spent the 8 hours overnight just building things and figuring out how to survive. And it actually seemed almost scarily addictive to me, so I was a little hesitant to dive into it, because I was afraid, and correctly as it turned out, that once I started playing it, I wouldn't really be able to stop. I like to read books on architecture and city design, and in particular, I've been a fan of Christopher Alexander for years and years, but this was the first time when I tried to consciously build something using his ideas. So in his recent works, he talks about the concept of strong centers a lot. And so when I was trying to make a garden on the roof of this building that I was hollowing out, I put a bunch of trees there, and I thought, no, that none of them really stand out very well. So I pruned away all the trees and then put one in the middle. And I thought that was a much... it was the roof looked much better with one tree than it did with either five trees or with no trees, because it gave a real focus to that part of the roof. One of the things that's I find a little paralyzing when trying to build in Minecraft is that you'll go wandering along, and then you'll find something that's just stunningly beautiful. You know, some mountain that's stretching up to the sky with a waterfall coursing down it and trees in just the right place. And you think, well, I would never want to build here because there's no way I could improve on that. But fortunately, the whole world isn't that beautiful. And so one of Alexander's points is that you shouldn't just draw up a plan you know, sitting in your office and then say, this is how buildings should be. Instead, he very much supports placing buildings in the physical context of the space where they're going to be located, and trying to build your buildings so that the presence of the building makes the surroundings a richer environment than it would have been if that building wasn't there. The aesthetics of the game, to me, strike a very good balance in supporting the player's creative work while not completely abdicating all of the aesthetics to the player choices. Like one of the things I like about my main house is maybe I'm doing some crafting or something like that, and then I'll turn around and I'll look out the window, and I've got on the same floor with the main crafting table there, I've got a window with a balcony door, and I'll just look out there, and the sun is setting, and I'll just stand there for a few minutes watching it, because it's really lovely. One of the defining aspects of Minecraft in the single player mode is that you have to go harvest your raw materials yourself, which, if you think about it in the abstract, that might seem to be a little bit tedious. I mean, if you've got some plan for a building that you want to build, then do you really want to have to, you know, go find your sheep to get the wool and then something to dye the wool, you know, the flowers, and dye the wool red so that you can have just the right red in the right spot? But the other thing about it is there's this notion that Naomi Clark and Eric Zimmerman call the fantasy of labor. And you see this also a lot in Facebook games, where it's this idea that if you just put your time in, you'll get your rewards, good things will happen. And this turns out to be something that I find surprisingly soothing. And so sometimes when I'm playing, I'm just not up for thinking about how I want to work on one of my houses next. And so then I'll just go down to one of my mines and just dig and dig and dig. Eric Zimmerman and Naomi Clark's idea of the fantasy of labor presents a world where it doesn't matter how talented you are, how rich you are, how poor you are, what have you, if you just put in your time, you will reap the results. And there's definitely an aspect of that in Minecraft, where you put in the hours and eventually you'll find the raw materials, and you may just be digging mindlessly, but you're doing something productive. I definitely feel the appeal of that. The flip side is this notion of prioritizing your work and making sure you're working on the right thing. Again, the fantasy of labor says, well, you're putting in your time and you're making progress by doing that, and you can even point to ways in which you're making progress. But if you let yourself get sucked into that too much and you forget to ask yourself, while acknowledging that this is productive, is it still the best way that you should be spending your time? Then you can end up looking up hours, days, weeks later and realizing that your accomplishments haven't meant as much to you as you would have liked.
In our final segment, Trevor Dodge spoke with Michael Abbott of Wabash College and BrainyGamer.com about the art of teaching games.
I was interested in the convergence that I saw happening with games and performative elements of theater and film, but particularly theater because that's my background, and the role-playing dimension of that prior to electronic games. Everything you do in the liberal arts is within a context of how can you think critically, how can you write more effectively, how can you communicate, how can you create a meaningful discussion. And so on that level, it almost doesn't matter what you're teaching. This idea that you're not supposed to have fun because this is higher education, you know, has become so deeply offensive to me. And it's part of what I think we guard against when the people who are teaching games in the classroom are always, I think, up against that fear that some of their colleagues might think they're just goofing off. We're so culturally trained to think that video games are a colossal waste of time. I do think one of the challenges, sort of on the humanities level, is it's easier with a game like BioShock because BioShock kind of wears its seriousness on its sleeve, you know, and then it's so clearly based on literature that you could go have them read. But it's kind of harder to claim with some students because of the cultural bias against games that it is in fact worth quote unquote reading into Mario. It's worth reading into games and try to understand what they mean, broadly defined. And there is resistance there. I mean, I think many of my students are like, really? Like, seriously? And yeah. So that's defeating that, or at least challenging it, is always an issue for me. Basically, I spend my life making the case for games. I mean, that's basically what I've devoted myself to in a broad sort of way, to think about how you can attack that problem. And it puts you in a weird position, I think, because sometimes you can be defensive and you'd be careful about that. And I think I've had issues with that. Just, you know, and I presume that I have to make the case for colleagues that may, in fact, have already bought it. You know, they don't need the case made. But I think what it also can do is, I think that I sometimes can feel so grateful for a game that's ambitious, and that I can kind of, I may be apt to overpraise it or try to shine too much of a light on it. That because we're still in that push pull between games as an industry and games are, you know, there's a cynical way of thinking about them. They just iterate on old formulas and, you know, we just repackage them and sell them. And then there's, you know, what they're doing with the next BioShock game, which is sort of wildly interesting to me. And I think we want to point at this game that just came out and say, look, that's what I'm talking about. That's what we can do. We focused on Portal in this college-wide course that's offered to all freshmen in their second semester, and it's when they make the connection between an idea which is presented outside the game. In this case, it's this, you know, text by Irving Goffman, sort of seminal text about how we perform ourselves for people, how we wear masks and present images of ourselves in order to make people like us or to get what we want or whatever. It's a sociology, you know, set of ideas. And the kind of beautiful discovery that a student has that can be expressed through gameplay, that can be expressed mechanically, actually, in embedded into an experience that communicates those ideas in ways that penetrate much more, or can penetrate much more than just the printed word. And I think it's that moment when they're like, oh, like, ah, I see what's happening here. Mm-hmm. This really is worth investigating. It's all about that for them. When that happens, it's, you know, that's touchdown. So I got tenure by doing all the things that you're supposed to do. And that's what you do. And none of those, not a single thing I did prior to tenure had anything at all to do with games or interactive media or any even connecting point, really. It was all theater and some film stuff and, you know, very traditional kind of film studies work. And what I discovered doing all that was just how much I hated it and how meaningless it was to me. And I have to be careful here because I don't mean to be contemptuous of people. They're doing incredible work. And that's not just lip service. I mean, I read what they do. I love that work. I just think it has a very limited appeal. And for me personally, I feel like I busted free and that I'm able to have much more broad-ranging conversations that I think, frankly, are more useful. That doesn't necessarily make them more penetrating, or that in terms of the academic rigor and, you know, the number of citations and all the kind of peer review stuff that you would embed into a scholarly piece. I understand the value of those, but you know, no one reads that stuff. There is a select group of people that do, and that circle of people promote each other and help each other, and they support each other, and that can be a thriving, self-sustaining community, and I'm not saying that doesn't have a purpose, but I struggle to see a real strong connection between that body of work and what's happening in quote unquote the real world. So I don't do it anymore, and I've been asked to do a book or to do this or that. That would be an extension of what I'm doing, but in a more scholarly way. And it would feel to me so much like going back to jail, you know, like I'm out of there. So I love this. And I know it's not, I know when people come to my blog and they say, I like that piece, good job. That's not peer review. I'm aware that this is a different kind of conversation, but it's far more appealing to me. And I believe, I don't think I'm deceiving myself, that the kinds of really substantive conversations I've had with creators who make games, who sometimes email me and say, look, that thing you said, here's why we did that. And here's why that didn't make it to the finish line. That's why you didn't like it, you know, but next time we're going to try this. And we learned this and that, you know, and there is actually a dramaturgical connection between what some people are doing in the space and what the creators are making.
That concludes this episode of Playable Character. The music in our first segment today was by Monoise. The music in our Minecraft segment is by C418 and is taken directly from the Minecraft soundtrack, which I encourage everybody to go buy immediately. And the music in our final segment is by Minus Baby. The track we're going to leave you with this week is by Shale Riley. As always, you can visit our website at playablecharacter.com for links to stuff that we talked about during the show, as well as links to where you can find and download or purchase the music that you've heard in the show. You can follow us on Twitter at playablechar. We have a Facebook page, and you can, of course, get in touch with us directly by emailing info@playablecharacter.com. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Dance, cause everybody loves Japan. I'm drinking strawberry milk with my hands in my pants. I play age games all night. In the morning I enslave little monsters and I make them fight.
You get down without the nightingale. It seems like a waste of time with big sound.
Get near the mirror to make a shoujo frown. But never watch Sailor Moon when your roommate's around. Let's get puke, a drink, and sambuca. Break out your razor, that's hookah.